From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, leaders on Mackinac get a clear warning. Silicon Valley wants to wrestle the mobility crown from Michigan.
So the real question, I think, for Michigan is whether it can be different and it can write a different chapter.
U of M President Mark Schlissel challenges state decision makers. Don't just talk about supporting higher ed. Back it up with funding.
I don't think as a state we've developed the consensus around making long-term investments in the future success of our economy. We seem to get stuck on solving shorter-term problems.
And we go back to World War II when the Army worried the crucial Sioux locks could be attacked by the Nazis.
The approaches to the locks were essentially surrounded by these barrage balloon emplacements.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we continue exploring teen suicide as we talk about how we can best help young people struggling with mental health issues. But first, one of the big topics during this week's Mackinac Policy Conference is higher education, how to help schools turn out the workforce that Michigan's businesses need, and how to do that in the face of funding challenges. Here with us from Mackinac is the president of the University of Michigan, President Mark Schlissel. Welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, it's great to be on again.
So the University Research Corridor, of course, Michigan, Wayne State, and Michigan State, just out with the latest report on the contributions these schools have made, especially the life, medical, and health sciences. That is such a critical component of our state's economy, isn't it?
Well, it surely is. But one of the exciting things for me is being able to step in as a relatively new president to an organization that now has been going on for 10 years, this sort of consortium or collaboration amongst the state's three major research universities. And we serve the same public. We have the similar sets of goals, and we achieve them in complementary kind of ways. And each year we look at one of the sectors of the economy, and we try to focus in on the contributions of the research universities and what we can be doing better or differently to be even more valuable to the state.
Well, certainly when you figure 1 in 8 Michigan jobs are in these fields that we're talking about of life, medical, and health sciences, it matters to the whole state. And I see from the report that's actually growing.
It is growing. It's one of the few sectors in the state that through the recession actually gain jobs, and they're actually higher paying jobs. They're well-paying jobs. So it's a very attractive sector of the economy for our educational efforts. And the three universities, we turn out more graduates in the health and allied health professions and in medical research than any cluster of universities that we compared ourselves to in the country.
And certainly the numbers tell us there are some sizable contributions that the University Research Corridor schools are making in terms of academic research and development.
Yep. So, you know, there are really three things that we put out in effect. One is each of us have medical schools that involve taking care of patients. So we provide clinical medical care at U of M, for example, to over 2.2 million clinic visit patients. And then we've got a 1,000-bed hospital in Ann Arbor and affiliations in other parts of the state. So we're an enormous deliverer of very high-quality advanced clinical care. Then we train people. We train medical students and interns and residents and fellows, but also nurses and public health workers and biomedical researchers. And then the third thing we do is we produce new knowledge. We produce discoveries in the medical and biomedical field that eventually turn into new and better ways to diagnose and treat disease.
Certainly there was some big news that that broke this week that the University of Michigan Medical School just landed the biggest federal research grant in the history of the med school. What's the school going to be able to do with that $58 million NIH grant?
Yep, it's very exciting. It's called a CTSA. It's to take clinical and translational science and promote collaboration, not just between doctors, but between biomedical researchers and engineers or mathematicians or statisticians to sort of tap into the breadth of the university and work on clinical problems. Also doing it in collaboration with the many patients that volunteer to be involved in clinical studies at the same time they're getting their outstanding health care from University of Michigan docs.
So that's good news, but we certainly know President Trump's proposed budget has some big challenges, including a 20% cut to funding for the National Institutes of Health, an 11% cut to the National Science Foundation. What could this all mean for work and research, not only at the University of Michigan, but the other research schools?
Yeah, you know, essentially it would be devastating. You know, if you think about what are the things where the United States has an unambiguous global competitive advantage. And biomedical research for decades and decades has been a clear advantage of our country. We gave birth to the biotechnology industry, the biopharmaceutical industry, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of economic value. And it requires investment. And there's been a great partnership between the federal government in particular, agencies like NIH and NSF and EPA and even DOD, many federal agencies, and great universities. And for decades, it's made us the envy of the world. What the new administration's doing is somehow threatening that. And it doesn't make sense to me, because if we want to keep America strong and keep us as a global leader and keep our economy growing and provide great jobs for people and keep our fellow citizens healthy, this investment in research, particularly biomedical research, is amongst the best investments we could possibly make. So I'm puzzled how an administration that wants to grow American strength is thinking about underinvesting in an area where we're the global leader.
And when we talk about state funding, certainly we've seen in Michigan what other states have with the drop in state spending on higher education. I'm wondering what you're hearing, President Schlissel, from policymakers as you're there on Mackinac Island making the rounds. What do you think the long-range prospects for funding in higher ed in Michigan would be?
It's really challenging because I think the state leaders, starting with the governor all the way down, all of them appreciate the value of higher education in general, of research universities in particular. But at the end of the day, I don't think as a state we've developed the consensus around making long-term investments in the future success of our economy. We seem to get stuck on solving shorter-term problems, and it's very frustrating. So there's uniform support, but that support hasn't translated into the kind of investments that are necessary for us to be truly successful. So U of M is getting the same budget from the state that we got in 1997. And think of all the inflation since 1997. And we're 20% larger. We're educating 20% more students than we were 20 years ago, basically getting the same number of dollars. And, you know, that obviously can't go on if the university is going to continue being amongst the top handful of public research universities in the country.
Do you feel, President Schlissel, right now as we talk, that the University of Michigan is accessible to everyone in our state who has the academic qualifications to attend?
So there's an interesting answer to that question, Cynthia. The answer is, in reality, we are, but I don't think the public understands that we are. So we haven't done an adequate job reaching out to all the different communities around the state, not just Southeast Michigan, but Western Michigan, the center of the state, the UP. And having every student who aspires to, you know, really transform their life and the trajectory of their future through education to think about applying to their, you know, great public university that we have. And what we don't advertise well enough is that we're need blind in admission and that we provide full financial aid according to federal formulas. So for a typical family that makes $60,000 or $65,000 a year, our financial aid calculation is such that they won't pay any tuition. And we have to get that message out so that kids aren't afraid to aspire to a UM quality education for financial reasons.
When you talk about the federal formulas and student loans and student aid, how concerned are you about what the Trump budget holds for them? I mean, we've seen the president's proposal to cut the very student loan programs that help the kids that need the most help.
Well, you know, that would be enormously challenging. The most important of those programs are the Pell Grants, as you know. They're means tested, so it depends on your family income. And they'll give you significant amounts of federal dollars, not as a loan, but as a grant, to invest in your education. What we do in Michigan is we try to minimize the amount of loans that are in our financial aid packages, especially for students that come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Those families, $30,000 a year families, are terrified of debt, and I can understand why. So our aid packages for that tier of income consist of no loans. It's all scholarship aid. The other thing to keep in mind at Michigan at the University of Michigan is the default rate on our student loans is a 1% or 1.5% or something, way lower than the national average, which to me argues that we're not burdening students with loans that they can't afford. We're giving them an education that lets them borrow the money that it takes to get the education and then get a great job so they can pay back their debt.
You know, a recent op-ed, I'm sure you read it, by David Leonhardt in the New York Times, offers the view that colleges and, in turn, the American dream are truly under assault. I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about the political discourse around higher education in this country?
Yeah, you know, I read Leonhardt all the time, and he's pretty good on higher ed. I think what he's really saying is, historically in the United States, a college education has been the most certain vehicle of social mobility in our country. The ability of a person to sort of change the trajectory of their life by getting a great education. And I think as the cost of higher ed gets more expensive, loans become a bigger part of going to school. I think more and more students feel as if that education is not accessible to them. And that is an enormous threat for our country's future. The other thing I'm not happy about political discourse is some people are making the argument that maybe a college education isn't necessary for success. And what I would say is there are certainly jobs in our economy that don't require a college education. And college is not necessary the right thing for 100% of the public. You know, there are people that can get vocational education, be very talented workers, and earn a living wage. However, in an economy where most of the jobs are now knowledge sector jobs, creative jobs, if you're thinking about a 30 or 40 year future, education is critical. Higher ed is critical. The unemployment rate amongst people with 4-year college degrees is less than half of the general unemployment rate. The average salary of someone with a college degree is dramatically higher than someone without a college degree. So for many people, for most people, college really is a key component of a successful future.
University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel speaking to us from the Mackinac Policy Conference. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Cynthia. Thanks for your interest.
Coming up next, we look back at the World War II era history of the Sioux Locks and then hear about a new app that levels the playing field between a seller and a pawn shop. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When we think of Michigan's contribution to the war effort during the Second World War, we tend to think of the arsenal of democracy, Rosie the Riveters helping build thousands and thousands of B-24 Liberator bombers at Willow Run. But the American war effort also depended mightily on the Sioux Locks, to the point where the Army feared a Nazi attack on the locks. It's a piece of history worth revisiting, even as Michigan's U.S. senators and representatives today announce a new bipartisan bill aimed at getting $1 billion to upgrade the Sioux Locks. With us now is Bernie Arbic. He's author of Upbound, Downbound, A History of the Sioux Locks, and City of the Rapids, which is a history of Sault Ste. Marie. Bernie Arbic, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia.
Bernie, why was the U.S. military so worried about a potential attack by the Germans on the Sioux Locks during World War II?
Well, in that day, about 90% of the iron ore that was used in the steel mills that were, of course, producing tanks and jeeps and so forth came from Lake Superior ports, Minnesota and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so the Sioux Locks was a potential choke point for getting that iron ore to the steel mills. It was felt that if the locks could be disabled, it would be a huge hindrance to that war effort.
I'm curious what ways they perhaps thought that the Germans might be able to disable the Sioux Locks.
There were three possibilities that were considered. One, of course, was just getting saboteurs in the area who could, on a land-based operation, somehow disable them. A second method that was considered was what I think would have been suicidal-type bombing missions, but long-distance bombers from Norway going across the Arctic Circle could reach the Sioux Locks, presumably, and drop bombs on it. And then the third way that seems maybe a little far-fetched, but I guess they did consider it possible, was if German submarines could get into Hudson's Bay with parts of airplanes that could then be assembled, perhaps taking off on the ice and carrying out torpedo bombing raids. So those were the three possibilities. I think they were all considered to be fairly remote, but because of the importance of the locks, they had to be still considered.
And so what kind of defenses does the military, did they put up to protect the locks during World War II?
Some interesting things. I'll mention barrage balloons first, and that probably doesn't mean much to any of your listeners, but basically what they were large helium-filled and later, I think, hydrogen-filled, essentially dirigibles, or very large balloons, kind of like the Goodyear blimp that you see, that were tethered on cables up to 2,000 feet long. And from those balloons, there dangled a whole series of other cables. And so the approaches to the locks were essentially surrounded by these barrage balloon emplacements. If a torpedo bomber did try to come in to drop a torpedo into the approaches to the locks, they'd have to run a gauntlet of these steel cables. And, of course, if they hit one, they would just be torn apart. So that was one of the defenses. And from what I read, I believe it was one of only two or three places in North America where barrage balloons were actually deployed.
And I know it's not hard to find photos of barrage balloons, and I'm thinking even of D-Day plus 4 or 5 when you get shots of, for example, Omaha Beach. They put those up to protect that beachhead. They were, very densely packed, weren't they?
And you know, that's an interesting point. During World War II, there are not many photographs of barrage balloons at the Sioux because of security concerns. I was told that every day agents would visit the local photo shops to see if any photographs had been developed that could possibly be security risks. So we have a few historical photographs, but surprisingly not very many, and also of gun emplacements. That would be another defense effort. There was a unit called the 100th Coastal Artillery Unit, which was anti-aircraft guns. And I've never seen a really good photograph of any of those, but there were quite a few emplacements in the hills surrounding the Sioux. And even in Canada, by the way, there was upwards of 1,000 U.S. military that basically were assigned to Fort Brady that were stationed in nearby areas in Canada.
So there was no German attack, no Nazi sabotage, and the locks made it through World War II untouched. Now, has there ever been a breakdown for some other reason that caused a long shutdown of the locks?
I don't think there's ever been one that caused, anything like a disabling shutdown. There's been very short ones, certainly, and there was one, actually, it was before we entered World War II. It was in October of 1941. There's a railroad bridge that crosses the St. Mary's River just above the locks. And because it crosses the approach canals to the locks, they have to be movable railroad bridge. So there's two different types there. At that time, one of them was a swing bridge, which could swing 90 degrees and, let the boats through the canal. And another was what we call locally a jackknife bridge, but the proper name is a bascule bridge, which has two leaves that swing up, and when it closes, the trains can pass. And in October of 1941, a train was crossing, and that bascule bridge essentially collapsed, and a locomotive and the tender behind it went into the approach canal. There was actually two railroad men that lost their life in that. Immediately, they thought this could be sabotage, but they very quickly decided that was not the case. It was just mechanical failure of the bridge. But what that did then, with this locomotive in the bottom of the approach canal, and this would be on the Lake Superior side, ships couldn't pass. And at that time, that was the canal that was servicing the outer two locks, which were the main locks in use at that time. So it did disable shipping, and probably something like within 24 hours there was 60 ships anchored in Whitefish Bay above the locks that couldn't pass through. And so that really made the point, boy, this is a real crisis possibility could occur here.
And certainly, you know, looking ahead to our present time, we had early last year, a U.S. Department of Homeland Security report that indicated that if that big lock, the Poe lock, largest lock, were to be shut down for 6 months, the nation would be plunged into recession. We could see some 11 million jobs lost across the nation and, you know, halting auto and appliance production. So it certainly seems the locks are as strategically important to the U.S. today as ever.
Yeah, I have seen that report. It's got a very telling title, doesn't it? The Perils of Efficiency, kind of connected with the on-time manufacturing and so forth, that there just aren't the stockpiles you might think of iron ore at the steel mills. And so, yes, when you think of the auto industry and all the metal that goes into appliances and railroad tracks and cars and so forth, yeah, there would be a huge impact on things that go far beyond the steel mill workers and the iron mine workers and so forth.
Bernie Arbic of Sault Ste. Marie is the author of Upbound, Downbound. It's a history of the Sioux Locks. Also, City of Rapids, a history of Sault Ste. Marie. And I guess it's proof that the more things change, the more they remain the same.
In a way it is, yeah. And if I can just try to inject a little bit of humor, when I came up with that title, City of the Rapids, for Sault Ste. Marie, what I meant to imply, I didn't call it City by the Rapids or City at the Rapids. I said City of the Rapids because the rapids have shaped our history before a white man was here, really. That's the reason that the Native Americans concentrated in this area. There's an abundance of whitefish in the rapids. And, of course, that's the reason that the locks are necessary in the first place, with the difference in level of Lake Superior and the lower lakes, roughly 21 feet. The locks are needed in order for ships to be able to manage that difference. And when I was thinking of a title, I never really seriously considered it, but I thought of Sault Ste. Marie, the real Grand Rapids, because the rapids are huge. They're 3/4 of a mile, at least in their natural state. They were 3/4 of a mile across, about as long in terms of the fall. So it's just had, the rapids have had such a huge impact in shaping our history.
Bernie Arbic, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
Epiphanies.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
For centuries, people who needed fast cash have turned to pawn shops, pawning some personal treasure for a cash loan. There were pawn shops in China some 3,000 years ago, and they're still going strong today, including on our TV screens. Hardcore Pawn spent 9 seasons showing us what happened at a Detroit family-run pawn shop. Now there's a modern, new way to pawn an item. Instead of driving around from shop to shop, you can turn to a Michigan-based startup called Pawn Guru and do your deal online. Jordan Bernholtz is with us now. He's a co-founder of this Southfield-based company. Welcome.
Hi there.
Good to have you here. How did you and your co-founders come up with this idea of doing all of this pawn shop buying and selling online?
We knew we wanted to build an app that would help low-income Americans and people who are underbanked. And we went looking for opportunities in that space. And what we did is go from pawn shop in Detroit, 7 or 8 of them just driving up and down the city. And we had a backpack full of items. And we wanted to see, you know, how much money would each pawn shop offer us
for each item. Okay. What'd you find?
Well, we found that on average, the amount a pawn shop would offer us for the exact same item would vary by about 400%.
Okay. That's pretty significant.
Yeah. We had a diamond ring that, you know, got $65 at one shop and $1,000 at another.
Why are the discrepancies so big, do you think?
Well, you know, pawn shops have different specialties. They have different amounts of capital on hand. Perhaps one of the pawn shop owners woke up on the wrong side of the bed this morning. But, you know, when you're low income, when you're shut for cash, you don't have time to go from shop to shop like we did, and you don't feel empowered to negotiate. So we built a website where people can submit their items online, you know, that they want to pawn or sell, or even if they want to buy something. And we let them get offers from multiple local pawn shops so they can choose the one that's best for them.
That is great, especially with transportation being such a challenge for people, as you say, trucking all around, trying to find them and go back and forth. So let's say I want to sell a guitar I no longer need. I'd rather have the cash than having the thing sitting on a shelf. What happens? How do I work with Pawn Guru to do that?
So you'd go to our website. You'd put in that you wanted to sell a guitar. You'd take a picture of it, and you'd post it. And you'd wait for, you know, dozens of local pawn shops to write back to you with how much they'd pay for it. Musical instruments are an example of a kind of item where the offer spread is pretty significant. So some pawn shops are really skilled at appraising guitars and, you know, other musical instruments, whereas others aren't. And the ones that are going to be a little bit more skilled are going to be able to offer you more money in general.
So you said, so I'm the seller, and I can sit and I can, in my pajamas at home, surf around, figure out who's the best offer. And then I go and I do the deal with that pawn shop.
That's exactly right.
So you're a clearinghouse.
Yeah, we're a clearinghouse. In a lot of circumstances, people are using Pawn Guru, you know, not because, you know, they're especially strapped for cash. You know, so that's probably half of our users fall into the traditional underbanked pawn demographic. But the other half are just looking for a convenient local alternative to eBay.
Or Craigslist.
Or Craigslist. The advantage of going to a pawn shop, you don't have to package your item. You don't have to ship it. You don't have to wait 7 days for the money to hit your account. You take it there, done. And, you know, you're going to a professional, clean storefront. And unlike Craigslist, you're not meeting someone in a parking lot and hoping they bring cash.
Why'd you choose Southeast Michigan to launch Pawn Guru?
You know, we're all from here originally. This is where our families are, where our ties are. There's also a fantastic startup community that's grown up in Ann Arbor and in Detroit that we feel really lucky to be a part of.
Now, does it cost anything if I'm a seller for me to list my item?
Not at all.
Okay. How does it – so do the pawn shops pay you to be able to participate?
Yeah. So we've started, you know, charging pawn shops on a limited basis. It was important to us that – you know, so it's always going to be free for consumers. But in order to show pawn shops, which is sort of a traditional industry, the value of the internet, we had to keep prices low for a while. And we still do.
Well, I can see lots to love for a seller. Do pawn shops like Pawn Guru?
They do. I think it's a conceptual, you know, a couple of years ago when we started pitching this, it was a little bit of a conceptual stretch. But now we have, I think, over 1 in 4 pawn shops in the country. So a little over 3,000 pawn shops signed up to our website. And they love it because it brings in traffic they otherwise don't know how to get. 80% of there's a ComScore study that says 80% of consumers look online before making any kind of retail decision. And until now, there was no place for all those people looking online with items they wanted to pawn or sell to go to.
So again, you're a clearinghouse. And you say across the country? So you've pawn shops all over.
Yep.
And I assume your long-range plan is keep growing and keep adding pawn shops.
That's right. So long-term, we, like I said, have sort of two customer bases, your traditional underbanked consumer – and then, you know, just your regular person trying to sell an item, you know, really quick and get a fair price on it. And we're going to keep expanding into consignment shops and, you know, other sort of used goods stores for those folks. And then for people who are underbanked, we're going to keep looking for ways we can improve financial transparency and offer them, you know, savings products that don't take high fees.
So protecting the consumer in a big way.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty safe, Jordan, to say the pawn industry has a less than stellar reputation. I'm wondering what reactions have you gotten from potential investors when they learned that you were a startup kind of looking to kind of disrupt the pawn shop business and become a part of that conversation?
You know, I think investors can be a little bit wary at first. We're really lucky that we've gotten a lot of support from the Metro Detroit venture community, like Invest Detroit, which saw potential in us really, really early on. So we're really grateful for that. And I think that obviously pawn shops aren't a place people dream about going to in the morning, and we recognize that. But in a lot of ways, the industry has cleaned up its act in the past 30 years, and they're professional, clean, reasonably friendly places to go. And we think it certainly beats meeting a stranger in a parking lot.
And speaking of negative perceptions, I think for some pawn shops are thought of as a place that, you know, to buy or sell stolen goods. First, is that even a legitimate view?
So actually, every time you sell an item to a pawn shop, you're getting fingerprinted, they're taking your name. So the proportion of stolen goods at a pawn shop is much, much lower than it would be on Craigslist or eBay, where there's no such rules.
Do you do any precautions or anything on Pawn Guru to ensure that there aren't stolen goods being trafficked through the site?
Yeah, so every time someone sells something and goes to a pawn shop, we're, you know, the pawn shop is taking down their name, their address, their fingerprint, and we're also maintaining records of, you know, who's using our site. If you don't mind my saying, you know, mm-hmm. I think that to go back to your question about pawn shops having a negative reputation, mm-hmm. like I said, ideal world, we don't need pawn shops, but they're a much better alternative to payday loans for somebody who's really cash strapped. Payday loans, if you don't succeed in paying one back quickly, you're locked in a cycle of debt. And obviously, we don't want someone to lose, you know, a possession that has some meaning or value to them. But it's a lot better than being locked into debt for years and years and years.
Jordan Bernholtz is co-founder of the Southfield-based company Pawn Guru. And we want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, we'll speak with a young man who's been dealing for years with anxiety and depression.
It really just took that conscious effort to both accept and then work with my mental illness.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan spent the 20th century pretty much making itself the center of the auto industry. But it is crystal clear that Silicon Valley wants to wrestle that crown back for itself for the 21st century. And that warning is being sounded at the Mackinac Policy Conference this week. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now from Mackinac Island. And you and I have talked a lot on this program about Silicon Valley's interest in the mobility industry. What's different in what you're hearing from economic and business leaders this week on Mackinac?
I think just the seriousness and the purpose that is behind all this. You know, Steve Arwood, who's retiring as the head of the Michigan Economic Development Corp, basically said, listen, cars are the hottest thing in Silicon Valley right now. And this is an industry that has a very storied record of innovation and speed. Clearly, speed is not associated with the Detroit auto industry, at least not when its pure existence isn't on the line. And I think one of the messages here is that this competitive challenge is not going to go away. It's going to require these companies to act differently, to hire different kinds of people, to be led differently, and to move at a quicker pace. That's one of the reasons why Ford Motor Company got rid of its CEO, Mark Fields, last week and replaced him with Jim Hackett. I think there's a feeling they're not moving quickly enough, and they're not moving quickly enough in the right places to maintain the pace. And Steve's argument was we have to keep pace, and I think he's right.
And the we is really the entire state, isn't it? This is not just a challenge for Detroit and the Detroit 3, but it really is about the whole state.
Right. It's really about a public-private partnership. It's about a public-private partnership that lives beyond Steve Arwood, that lives beyond Governor Rick Snyder, that lives beyond the current legislature, that is really analogous. And where we started the conversation was talking about the Pure Michigan tagline that has been Michigan has used for the past 10 years, which was unveiled up here. Some of your listeners may remember about 10 years ago to buy Jennifer Granholm to a lot of wet eyes as people blubbered listening to this this Pure Michigan campaign, and it has proven to be very, very effective. And it's a good idea that has lived through administrations, through Republicans and Democrats. And I think this, what they're trying to do with mobility and what they call Planet M and branding that and making Michigan a home or a centerpiece of mobility for the 21st century is something that there needs to be a sense of purpose and they need to continue to do it. It can't be a flavor of the month because this is really not going to go away. Now, there are going to be some hiccups along the way. There's going to be situations unsure, unfortunately, when someone is going to get badly injured or killed in an autonomous vehicle and it's going to be a crisis for that technology, but it will probably continue to move forward. And I think what he's trying to say is, look, this is not going to go away. The old auto industry as we traditionally knew it is very different.
And all through your column today in the news, you are citing person after person after person, pretty much singing from the same hymnal.
That's right. I think the people who are thinking about this, who are looking at the world around them, are saying this is reality, this is here to stay. Now, you have to juxtapose that to the rhetoric we heard during the presidential campaign last year, both from Republicans and Democrats, that somehow you could change NAFTA, for example, and you could roll back the job losses, and all of a sudden you could have more people working in auto plants than do today,
or coal.
Right. And as I think we've discussed, I mean, you know, that's a convenient way of looking at things. But people forget the fact that that same 20-year period is when the Detroit auto industry was losing market share like it was water, and fielding a lot of products that were very mediocre, and losing those sales to largely Japanese and other Asian manufacturers. So it's not just a trade thing, and to suggest that somehow this can be rolled back, I think, is fanciful. We live in a global economy. It's constantly changing. There are trade and other kinds of political shifts that will impact that, but to think you can put the proverbial genie back in the bottle, I think, is just not being honest with people.
And as you point out in your column today, that whole culture of innovation and risk-taking that's needed to pull this off and keep this crowned in Michigan, mm-hmm. It already happened with the likes of Henry Ford and the early auto innovators. So do leaders on Mackinac think Michigan has the right stuff for the 21st century to do it again?
Hard to tell. I mean, you clearly have, I think, in some of the car companies and in some of the major suppliers, you have some people, I think, who recognize that they need to be more risk-taking and they need to be more entrepreneurial, and they're trying to do that, but they're moving very big organizations. You know, when Henry Ford started Ford Motor Company in 1903, he'd started and failed two other car companies. It eventually grew into the one of the largest automakers in the world. It was a very much a vertically integrated company. It's very different today, but it's created bureaucracies that are very hard to move. I talked with Walter Isaacson, the famous author, this morning up here, and we got into that very discussion, is that historically those kinds of bureaucracies have a very difficult time responding to dramatic change in their world. So the real question, I think, for Michigan is whether it can be different and it can write a different chapter. And just because it hasn't been done in the past doesn't mean it can't be done now.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with us from the Mackinac Policy Conference. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We continue exploring teen suicide and mental health issues among our young people, talking with a parent, a school principal who lost her father to suicide, and today, a young man from Dexter. Spencer Waltz is 25. He began struggling with anxiety back when he was in grade school. He speaks from hard-won experience and talking about how we can best help young people struggling with mental health issues and overcoming fears that talking about their mental health will cause more problems. Spencer Waltz, welcome.
Thank you.
So good to have you here. So your struggles go back to what, fifth or sixth grade?
Yeah, and even before that, I think my parents first started noticing signs, probably around second or third grade. Things like not eating well and maybe avoiding going to sleep or avoiding going to friends' houses. Stuff that I didn't really think was out of the ordinary, but I think from their perspective, maybe were some red flags. And it's important to note that both they themselves had struggled with mental illness. So I think they kind of knew what to look for. But at that point in second and third grade, it wasn't really interfering with daily life. It was just kind of my own little quirks.
It was who you were.
Correct.
So at what point did things begin to slide toward, hey, we have a problem and we need to do something about it?
Yeah. My anxiety kind of peaked that winter semester of fifth grade. Early on, again, we still didn't quite know what exactly it was. I would make up excuses that I had strep throat for the 20th time just because that was easier for me to understand and make sense of.
To keep from having to go to school?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And even to tell kids at school that you know, I didn't want to tell them I miss school or I'm not comfortable in school because I have anxiety.
What did that anxiety feel like to you as a fifth grader? What was it happening inside and how were you feeling?
So early on, it was just kind of the classic fight or flight experience. So a lot of panic attacks and seemingly out of nowhere. It's important to note I had a big-time phobia of vomit, and a lot of my anxiety displaced itself in fear of either being in a situation where I myself was going to get sick or I was going to see someone get sick. And most of the time, at least early on, it wouldn't take much for the anxiety to kind of take control and snowball in my own head and make itself known as a full-blown panic attack.
So what did Mom and Dad say and do at the point when, you know, it became clear that we've got a problem?
First step was to go to our family doctor, same one that I had went to a number of times and hoped that it would be something other than anxiety. And I think he always, you know, enforced and reiterated that we need to do something else other than something out of his own hands.
Psychotherapy.
You know? Yeah.
Okay.
And again, my parents weren't afraid of that. They have had experienced that themselves. So it was more just an acceptance practice of, hey, we got to try to nip this in the bud and get help for Spencer. So a big part of that was sitting down on winter break of that fifth grade year and deciding if I was going to go back to school. Half of me was like, I really don't want to go to school. You know, I just want to hang out with Dad, who was self-employed. That seemed a lot easier and more manageable to me. And I think my parents understood that. And we did make the decision as a family that I wouldn't go back to school that semester.
Almost like hitting the reset button.
Yeah,
for
sure.
Right?
And it was kind of the wake-up call that I needed. And it allowed me to jump full force into a treatment plan as well, which a lot of times life could get in the way of that. And it makes it super hard to say, hey, I really got to put myself first and do what I got to do to kind of flip this around.
So you took that half year off. How long before you went back?
I think it was probably 3 or 4 weeks. And in that time, it took a lot of garnering support and letting people in. We got the school on board, which was hugely effective. I remember a meeting to set up our 504, our IEP plan.
And for people who don't know what that is?
It's accommodations for students with disabilities. So I think I think the number is 13 different mm-hmm. disability categories. That,
and one's emotional impairment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you started with a 504 plan, which meant what? What kind of ways did the school accommodate your disability?
So they sat me down in the initial meeting with, you know, I was there with all the big wigs. I didn't think I was going to have to talk. And they said, Spencer, what do you think would help you in terms of managing your anxiety? And I'm like, what the heck?
What to put on a fifth grader.
But, but I completely felt empowered and I really respected their ability to trust me and know that I wanted to be in school and wanted to feel better. So I asked for things like going on walks with a couple friends that were at that same meeting. If I could just leave the classroom, a big thing for me was worrying about a teacher saying no to me. If I said, hey, I'm not feeling well, can I just go walk around or something? So I had a couple friends that I could do that with. Another big thing was having a resource room that I could go to and kind of just do my funky looking breathing exercises and muscle relaxation. And I could also do schoolwork there. And early on, that was kind of a safe haven because it was even hard for me to go inside the double doors at school. I mean, initially after having that break, it was, as you can imagine, the anxiety was kind of at its highest thinking about having to go back to school after I had thought, hey, I had a whole semester off.
This was like your kind of safety valve.
Correct.
You know, when you had this room you could go to.
Correct. And again, a big thing, and it's still a big thing for me right now, is just letting people in. And I think that meeting and having everyone on the same page was enough for me to feel empowered and say, hey, I can do this.
Now, no mental health issue is like a 5 visits, done, wrapped up,
correct,
we're good. So you continued wrestling with these issues even in college, right? You were struggling in college. What was going on?
I think a big part of me wanted to kind of box up and compartmentalize that sixth grade or fifth grade experience and forget about my anxious past. And I think I wanted the best 4 years of my life to be in college and kind of bought into that and didn't think anxiety or depression could creep its head again. College is a stressful time. I think we all know that. And
did that uncork it again for you?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And I think I was both grateful that I had my past and my experiences to kind of recognize when things weren't right or normal for me. Yet at the same time, I think I held on a little bit too long and tried to push through it and didn't let people in and didn't talk about it as early as I wanted to.
How bad did it get?
I felt more the depressive side of things in college more so, which was a whole nother monster for me. I was used to kind of the panic attacks and the constant on-edgeness. And I was then faced with sleeping all the time and suicidal ideation.
So you had that idea pop into your mind of suicide?
Yeah, absolutely. And I never was impulsive or never had a plan or anything, but it got to the point where, and I think that's pretty consistent with depression, is it convinces you that that's an option and that's a way out of kind of that doom and gloom space that you occupy most of the day. So
how'd you get out of this?
Same treatment plan that I jumped in.
Did you bring it up to your parents or did they notice?
Yes. And the idea of school came back in and it came from a motivation of mine where, again, similar feelings to fifth grade where I just didn't want to be in school. And I think they respected that. They understood that. You know, I told them I was struggling. I told them that I think I could feel a whole lot better if I could lean on some more supports and not have that stress ball that college is to worry about. And they agreed. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to take a break from school. And again, I went back on medication. I went back to psychotherapy. I sleep, diet, and exercise are biggies for me. So I really had to hone those in. It really just took that conscious effort to both accept and then work with my mental illness.
And here you are as a volunteer with NAMI, Michigan. What are some of the things you're doing? Because I'm sure as you're reaching out to others, you're also reinforcing your own recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. Advocacy is a huge, huge part of recovery for me. And NAMI has been a great space for me to explore that. They allow me to facilitate a support group every other Wednesday for young adults. It's just a great space to talk about life. And I have a lot of college-age kids, so it's great to get that perspective. And I mentor a 10-week psychoeducational course called NAMI Peer-to-Peer, which is for those that are living with. We get a lot of participants that are just recently diagnosed or maybe still in crisis. And there's such a shared experience and feeling of, wow, I'm not the only one that is going through this, that course really reinforces.
That must be so important to realize what you just said.
Right.
I'm not the only one. And you find out other people are wrestling with the same demons.
Right. Yeah. And even if someone themselves isn't struggling with something, I've found that almost everyone knows someone that has gone through something similar. And even just talking about it and breaking the ice is so therapeutic in a lot of ways.
Spencer, from your experience, what do you feel are the most helpful ways for parents to step in and get involved? I mean, things that parents might say to start the process that won't result in their child shutting down and tuning them out.
I'd say start with understanding and raising their own awareness. I think there's a sense of fear around something you don't understand, and I think that's certainly true if your own child is going through something that you don't understand. And I think by raising your own awareness and being with other people that have been through similar experiences, that's only going to help in terms of your treatment of your own child. And I think another kind of overarching theme that I always try to stress to parents especially is that it's okay that your child's going through what they're going through. And I think a lot of times there's a tendency to make a child feel like they're in the wrong or they're a bad kid, even though they're kind of having emotions that we all have, you know.
And parents might feel,
absolutely, yeah,
what
yeah.
did I do wrong here?
Absolutely.
So you've got to get past that.
Yeah.
And what's your message to any young person who's listening to you talk right now, feeling as though anxiety or depression is getting the best of them?
First and foremost, it's okay. That's got to be my first message. It's okay to be feeling how you're feeling. I think a lot of times, whatever the illness is, it can get you swarmed up and make you feel like it's completely not okay. But I think having that attitude of acceptance and gratitude even is so important in terms of kind of tackling what you got to do to put yourself first and feel better a little bit. And I think on top of that, I've always tried to reinforce how much talking and just letting people in has been therapeutic for me. And I think just in terms of mental illness in general, there's not too much talk. And I think that
stigma keeps people from talking.
Absolutely.
It
yeah.
shouldn't.
Yeah. And secrets, secrets definitely make you sick. And I think that's something that I've really accepted. Again, it's so important to talk if you can and find at least one person that can be that rock for you.
Spencer Waltz, who is a volunteer with NAMI Michigan, and certainly their website is full of resources and ideas and support groups for anyone who is dealing with a mental health issue or loves someone who is. Spencer, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.